If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. And I am excited because I have an exciting guest here, a very important person in veterinary medicine, and we are going to learn why this one person has influenced, if you have a dog, if you have a cat, more than you ever knew, but now will know about. Dr. Niels Petersen, University of California, School of Veterinary Medicine, Professor Emeritus right now. And good morning, Dr. Petersen.
Yeah, good morning, Steve, and thank you for having me on your program.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to speak with you, and I want to start with a topic that you've talked a lot about. We're going to get to a variety of other topics. We'll talk about aging in cats. We will talk about feline diseases. Are we truly seeing, for example, less feline immunodeficiency virus or feline leukemia where perhaps we don't need those vaccines? The most popular dog breed is the French Bulldog, and among the other most popular breeds are other dog breeds who have these kind of pushed-in faces. We call them brachiocephalic dogs, and you have done many studies about many things, including that in particular. So we'll get to all of that, but I want to talk about what is arguably the most timely of topics, and that's feline infectious peritonitis, or FIP. When I first met you, which at this point, I don't know, probably over 20 years, in fact, it was over 20 years ago, Dr. Petersen, others were saying to myself and other board members of the nonprofit organization, now the Every Cat Health Foundation, stop raising money for FIP because you'll never raise enough money to make a difference. And it turns out that this disease caused by a coronavirus doing a mutation in generally kittens that had been considered fatal, thanks to your work greatly, Dr. Petersen, is no longer considered fatal. Was there any point in time where you thought, I'm going to stop with this FIP stuff because it's not going anywhere and it's not going to go anywhere?
Yeah, you have to realize, Steve, that FIP has always been kind of a pastime for me. I've always had, you know, teaching duties. I've had research in other areas. I've had administrative functions, different things. So FIP was always something I put in the side. You know, I had to raise money for other diseases. You know, we discovered FIV. We had an NIH grant for that. We were studying feline leukemia virus at a time when people were interested in the possible relationship of retroviruses to cancer in humans. And so had money for those things, but didn't have any money for FIP. So kind of borrowed a little bit of money, a little technician time, a little here and there to do the FIP on the side. So FIP was always not my major emphasis, and although it is a disease I seem to be most associated with currently.
Well, it is, because you're the guy who made the difference. And I'm not going to tell the story, and you could tell it much better anyhow, and you weren't alone. I mean, researchers all over the globe were trying to figure this out because kittens were left and right all over dying of this disease. And once diagnosed, if it could even be, if you go back at a certain point in time, very difficult to diagnose. The disease wasn't even understood. You helped make all of that happen. But what's more, you came to our scientific advisory group and said, I've got a drug. Well, you didn't say it quite that way. That I think is going to make a difference. And it turned out to be a drug that was failed in use for the Ebola virus in people. It didn't do much good for that. And you said, I think this antiviral drug can help. Can you pick it up from there?
Yeah, I had reached a point in the career where we understood the origins of FIP, the fact that it was due to a mutant form of the common enteric coronavirus. And we'd taken it as far as we could And it was at a time when there was great interest in antiviral drugs, you know, and HIV and hepatitis and all of that. So I noticed that this company called Gilead was doing research on antivirals for Ebola, and it so happened I was a colleague, and I co-published papers when I was at the Primate Center studying simian AIDS with one of the co-founders, one of the leaders of Gilead. So I saw that they had been doing a lot of work on on antiviral drugs for Ebola. And Ebola is an RNA virus, so basically I thought, well, it's possible that it might work here as well. And I saw some preliminary work by Yeon-Jung Kim at Kansas State University, which would suggest that these drugs might, that there may be drugs that would work. She was working on what's called a protease inhibitor at the time and showing some effect in rodent models. But anyway, so I contacted this colleague at Gilead, and to make a long story short, it took me over almost 2 years before we got all the paperwork and all the legal entanglements between a university and a company straightened out, where we actually could work together on research looking at this drug, which they call remdesivir. And remdesivir is a drug which is metabolized in the body, and it releases this compound called GS441524, which we will call GS, so it's what's called a prodrug. So it releases the active ingredient, which is the GS. And so they sent us a battery of drugs, and we screened those drugs. And it's so after working together, and we would do a lot of the tissue culture work, and they would do a lot of the assays, viral assays. And so it was a team. We were working together really well. And, of course, this was at the time when they were hoping that their drug remdesivir would be found effective against Ebola. But anyway, when we tested all these compounds, we found two compounds that were very inhibitory of feline coronavirus. And it turned out that one of them was remdesivir, because they were all labeled secretly. We didn't know what they were. And so one turned out to be remdesivir, and one turned out to be the active ingredient, the GS441524. So we were very excited about that. And we had done some work a little earlier with Yeon-Jung Kim at Kansas State on her protease inhibitors, and found that they were effective against the disease in a small proportion of cats, but they would not penetrate the brain enough to combat the neurologic form of FIP.
All right, Dr. Peterson, I need to stop you there because we have to pause for commercials. But when we come back, what I want to know is, all right, what happened from that story? I mean, cats with FIP are now living, and also how this has impacted human health as well, and where to get the drugs from, because there's been a huge change in that. And we'll talk about dogs too, all when we come back with Dr. Peterson on WGN. Dr. Niels Peterson is truly a superstar in veterinary medicine, and I'm not just saying that because he's on the telephone. He knows how I feel, but it's not only about how I feel. I will tell you, if somehow, some way, one were to list the most influential veterinarians of the past 25 years, a top three list, I don't know who would be on that list, but for sure, you would be on that list, Dr. Peterson, because you've impacted our pet's health in so many different ways. And for every pet parent out there, even if they don't have any idea who the heck is he talking to, you ought to get a thank you note, because for all that you have done for our animals single-handedly and with the help of many others and funding to make it possible. And we're talking about feline infectious peritonitis, or FIP. All right, so you've got the drug, you do the clinical trials. Were you even surprised by the positive results?
No, we were totally amazed because not only was the drug entirely safe, it had no toxicities that we could determine other than the pain and inflammation when on the injection, but these cats within 24 to 48 hours were amazed that the fevers would go away. They'd become active. They were playing. They were jumping. They're doing all sorts of things, and by a week, you couldn't even recognize them as being sick. So, no, it amazed us, and the fact. And then the rest of the work was basically trying to figure out what a safe dosage was, and how long we needed to treat for the various forms or various appearances, clinical appearances of the disease, and. We discovered that certain forms had to require longer treatment and higher dosages, but eventually this became well known. I presented my data at several international conferences, and a lot of visitors were there from overseas and were busy taking pictures of my slides and everything. So the information got out very rapidly to the general public.
So let me ask you a question about that. Is FIP today considered? So I, as you know, I was there when the announcement was made that feline infectious peritonitis is no longer considered fatal and is now considered treatable. Today, in 2026, is FIP considered treatable still, like it was, or is it considered curable?
Well, we don't know the exact, because we don't know how many years you need to follow these, but, you know, we have cats that are out 6 years or more now, and the recurrence rate has been extremely low. In fact, we don't know whether these recurrences, which are rare, are new infections, or actually recurrences of the old. But for all practical purposes, we believe that most of them are permanently cured. And the cure rate is about 90%. And no matter who does the study in the world, they come out with a figure in the high 80s or low 90s percent success. But the sooner you can treat them and the more vigorous you can treat them, the higher the success rate.
Like a lot of things. Did you ever think, though, that you would be saying what you just said to anyone 20 years ago? Would you have predicted that FIP would actually be considered, whether it be treatable or curable or somewhere in between?
Well, you know, I'd always had hopes. You know, we've always had hopes for vaccines, but that never worked out. In fact, the vaccine research failed so badly so many times that the drug companies just refused to even entertain any new concepts. It isn't to say that it can't be preventable, vaccines, and I think that's an area that needs to be studied with modern technology. But nonetheless, it was pretty hopeless when it looked like vaccination was impossible and symptomatic treatment. These cats just wouldn't recover. You know, once they got sick, they would die no matter what we treated. You know, in rare cases, there was a spontaneous remission, but it was so rare that it wasn't even worth talking about. But anyway, I think the early success with the protease inhibitors with Yeonjong Kim from Kansas, and most importantly, the GS study that we did with Gilead and published, where we successfully cured experimental as well as natural infection, was dramatic. And again, it was late in my life. You know, I'll be 83, and this came late in my life, and it was like a gift from God that came into my my hands, which, you know, was the dream to be one of the first to isolate the virus, one of the first to determine how the virus mutated to cause disease, and all of these different forms of the disease that were occurring, and then to come up with then vaccine studies which were not successful, and then to come up with a cure so late in my career, you know, was like a capstone. It was like, how could you have a better career than to work on something all your life, trying to find a way to either prevent it or cure it, and then come up with a cure at the end, you know?
Well, it gets better than that because you know the story. I've told you privately that, but everyone on the radio who heard the last time I spoke to Dr. Anthony Fauci, I explained this. You mentioned the drug Remdesivir earlier. So I said, did you know that a drug originally used to help treat cats with feline infectious peritonitis that is caused by a coronavirus, but FIP isn't directly a corona. It's caused by a coronavirus. It was considered a stretch, but the U.S. government was so desperate to find an antiviral, they looked at Remdesivir, the same drug that you said can work for cats. They looked at Remdesivir to help people with COVID-19. And today, thousands among thousands of people are living around the world because of Remdesivir. But I suggested to Dr. Fauci, who agreed, that if it wasn't for cats getting FIP, if it wasn't for the nonprofit that helped fund your work called the Every Cat Health Foundation, but mostly if it wasn't for Dr. Niels Petersen figuring out all that out, we wouldn't have Remdesivir today, to this day, to help treat people with COVID-19.
You know, I think that's a little bit much. I don't want to take that much credit, but I have to say that we were treating cats successfully for a year and a half or almost two years before the COVID-19 pandemic occurred. So we had a lot of experience with the drug, at least with the active ingredient, the GS441524. And so basically, I mean, I can't say how much our work influenced them, but I hope that they saw our work as to how effective this was against coronavirus in cats, to really embark on a really intense research effort and clinical effort to get Remdesivir tested and approved for human use. You know, I would like to think we had a role to play, but you know how much history will straighten that out.
I suppose so, but I think what I said is a true story. Dr. Fauci agreed, and I agree. We'll be right.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
Right back on WGN. Good morning. Steve Dale here, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN with Dr. Niels Petersen, a professor emeritus, University of California, School of Veterinary Medicine at Davis. And before we get on to other topics, Dr. Petersen, I do want to go over this to help people. So originally, when you figured out, okay, I've got a drug here that will help, but the U.S. government, Food and Drug Administration Center for Veterinary Medicine, did not approve officially of that drug, the only way to get that drug was to go online and get it through the quote-unquote black market, typically from China. Not ideal, but it turned out those products, according to studies that have been done, really did work. The Chinese replicated kind of accurately what that drug was. So we had many cats' lives saved all over the globe. Do we still need to do that? Do we still need to go to, and it's wonderful, 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 that groups online, like one was called the FIP Warriors. There are others as well that help make this all possible, saving cat lives. However, do we still need to go that route, Dr. Petersen?
Yes, the answer is yes and no. First of all, the problem was that we could not get the rights to use GS to treat cats. We had to wait for Remdesivir to get approval for use in humans. Remdesivir wouldn't be the drug of choice. It's more expensive. It, 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 the uh, the active ingredient GS is the real thing, but we couldn't get the Gilead to give us rights to move it into animal. And I understand part of it is that there was this concern that something that we were going to do about getting approval and licensing of GS was going to interfere with the effort to get remdesivir approved and marketed for humans. And there was an intense, as you know, effort to get remdesivir, to get a drug, antiviral drug, on the market for humans. So regardless of what happened, the problem was is that we had no legal source of the active ingredient, so basically people started relying on the black market, which the Chinese chemistry companies were seemingly able to do very nicely. But then we had to have somebody to administer the drugs, and the veterinarians were, by and large, most of them, not all of them, but most of them refused to use the drug and to treat cats at FIP because they thought morally it was illegal because it wasn't formally approved by the FDA. So we needed, if the veterinarians weren't going to be willing to do the treatment, who was? Well, it was taken up by cat owners and cat groups, people that ran shelters, people that ran rescue groups and so forth, and owners. So a whole parallel structure was developed very rapidly, which allowed for the manufacture of the drug. The drug was then brought into the hands of people that were able to administer it. You know, these were not by and large veterinarians. These were by and large cat lovers and people with a lot of veterinary experience, you know, shelter people and people that have been doing rescue work who had a lot of veterinary knowledge. And so basically we developed a parallel mechanism to obtain the drug. One could say illegally, one could also, you know, I'm not sure I like that term, but and I'm not sure I like black market. Let's just say it was unapproved, you know, unapproved but active, okay? And so we had an unapproved but active source, good effective source of the drug. We created these warrior groups, FIP warrior groups, and similar groups all over the world, to obtain and be the go-betweens and take the place of the veterinary profession in providing treatment for all of these cats. And in the last, the first approval that would allow enough drug to get in the hands of veterinarian in a quasi-legal sense was only within the last year and a half or so. So there was a period of 5 or 6 years that all of the drug, all of the cats that were being treated, most of them were being treated by these groups all over the world. And
but
so,
today,
that was the reality.
Yeah, that was. But today, that was. How about today?
It's a mixture today because there are still the drug is not officially approved in the classical sense, like an FDA drug is. You know, remdesivir, is officially approved, and as being officially approved for human use, it can be used by veterinarians. It can be prescribed by veterinarians for diseases that it would work against, but its approval is by a loophole in the law, so it's a very loosey kind of approval. And there are certain commercial drug companies that can market it to veterinarians, and veterinarians can obtain it. But there's still a lot of veterinarians, surprisingly, that are not picking it up that much. You would
really
think they would, but they're not. So there's still a lot of, and other places of the world still don't have approved drugs. So, you know, we do in some countries, but not in all. Like a lot of the Middle East countries and some of the Asian countries, where the disease is a big, big problem, they don't have maybe the same legal approvals that we have. So basically, it's a mixture now, and I don't know what percentage, but I would guess that the majority of cats are still being treated through the unapproved marketplace or the unapproved pattern. You know,
before we run out of time for the segment, and I do want to talk about other things in our next segment. I would suggest though that. Veterinarians now, I mean, they couldn't work with these companies from China, and they were concerned about their license if they did because it was unapproved or black market, whatever we call it. However, though it is a slippery sort of thing in the law, it is still legal that companies like Bova and Wedgewood, and there are many others, that are now providing compounded versions of these drugs. And those companies work with veterinarians on all sorts of drugs all the time, including now these FIP drugs. They've also come down in price this way as well. When we come back, we're going to be talking dogs. That's right. And other topics with the great Dr. Niels Peterson on WGN. He is the one and only multi-award winning veterinarian, Dr. Niels Peterson, Professor Emeritus, University of California, Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. We've been talking about cat diseases, one in particular, feline infectious peritonitis, which you are most known for playing a role in. But for people who know better, we know the role you played as far as understanding brachiocephalic dog breeds. Those are the dogs that look like they walked into a wall. I'm talking about French bulldogs and Shih Tzus and Pekingese, and there are many others. And there is a growing issue of brachiocephalic airway obstruction, which means, and you'll explain it better than I can for sure in a moment, but these dogs have difficulties, medical difficulties, and as a result of that, sometimes behavioral difficulties as well. And they happen to be among the most popular dog breeds. In fact, French bulldogs, according to the American Kennel Club, are again the most popular dog breed in America. So can you talk about brachiocephalic dogs a little bit?
Well, brachiocephalic breeds are very popular, and there's a lot of reasons that people give for it, but one of the ones that's most attractive is that they see in the faces of a brachiocephalic dog their own faces, because, you know, our faces tend to be flat, and so a lot of the brachiocephalic breeds have more human facial, and a lot of them have great personalities. They're great for apartments. They're smaller. They're loving, many of them, most of them. And they're very popular. But one of the things is this whole idea that we see in, we want to humanize our dogs as much as possible because we're more and more treating them as child substitutes.
Right. So these dogs have become incredibly popular, but they also have incredible problems. I mean, it's not quote unquote normal when someone says, oh, you have a French bulldog, it snores all night long. Well, that's not a good thing, it seems. And that's just or a dog that's brachiocephalic that literally, if it's 75 degrees hot, but not that hot for sure, can't even walk around the block.
Yeah, it's a big problem and a growing problem, because the more brachiocephalic, the more extreme the facial changes, the more extreme the brachiocephaly, the more changes to the upper airways, which then are reflected on the lower airways. As most people that have severe snoring problems are on CPAPs and that to stay alive. These dogs don't have they're not, at least as I don't know yet, are on CPAPs at night.
And also, waking up periodically through the night, not getting a good night's sleep, would impact my mood the next day. And it turns out to impact dogs' moods as well. So sometimes these dogs get a bit testy with the kids that are pushing them around where they otherwise normally wouldn't. So we have behavioral issues as well. So I know at one point you push toward less, I'm going to put this in my words, but less extremism, so we don't see this to the extent that we're seeing the problem today?
Yeah, let me just go back. I was director of the Veterinary Genetics Laboratory at UC Davis for 15 years or more, and I had the laboratory change its emphasis from horses mainly and livestock into pets and mainly dogs. And I did a study on genetic study on English bulldogs, which was highly cited and very controversial. But anyway, so I just want people to know that this is an area that I have actually worked in. So your question again was...
Would you like to see less extremism? I know in the UK they've been pushing for that. Would you like to see our Kennel Club, which has been totally silent on this topic, or others say, all right, and some of the breed clubs are paying more attention, but would you like to see even more attention played?
Well, you know, we wrote that paper on the genetic background of English bulldogs. We made a statement that they were so inbred, and especially huge regions of their genome were completely the same, and that they had reached a point where they could not improve the breed by selection. They would have to outcross to normal dogs and to make them less extreme. And, of course, the French bulldog at one time was less extreme, was a more active dog, had less breathing problems, and so it became popular, probably because the bulldogs were having more and more problems. Unfortunately, now, because French bulldogs are so popular, and the problem with further refinement of their brachycephaly is causing more problems. So we're ending up getting a lot of the same problems in the French bulldogs as we had in the bulldogs. But yeah, I would like to see, and breeds have been created, by the way, based on the English bulldog, new breeds that are outcrosses that are less extreme with their facial changes and body function, and that are more active, much more ambulatory, less breathing, more normal breathing problems. And so there are some of these new breeds being developed, because the established breeds, the French bulldogs, English bulldog breeders, basically refuse to outcross. And so what has happened is that new breeds are created that are based on these breeds, but are not as extreme and do not have nearly the number of health problems. And this movement is especially seen in European countries. And in some European countries, certain breeds now are declared illegal based on the fact that they have too many genetic defects. It's unfair to the dog. They're too aggressive in case of dog breeds based on the American pit bulls. And so there is a change, but not so much in the United States, but in Europe there is a change looking at health as being an important part of the thing. And, of course, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, Dr. Peterson, we literally only have 30 seconds left. I have like 30,000 questions I can't ask you because we're almost out of time. I want to know in that 30 seconds, no more, what do you want to be remembered for most? Because you've done so much.
I want to be remembered as being a great veterinarian that made a difference, especially with dogs and cats. I started off to be a bovine veterinarian, but anyway, yeah, I want to be just known as a great all-around veterinarian who made some great discoveries all the way around.
Well, I thought you were going to say you want to be remembered as the guy that could laugh when Steve Dale told a funny joke, but that's not what you said. Dr. Peterson, you know you are beloved for a reason by your colleagues and by pet parents who do know the stories. Thank you so much for your time, always. Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
It's cats that are rapidly reshaping the economics of veterinary medicine. According to a new report from the Catalyst Council, the U.S. feline veterinary market generated an estimated $12.7 billion in practice revenue in 2025. However, the council projects a far larger opportunity. If cats receive veterinary access and care intensity comparable to dogs, the market could expand much further than that to over $30 billion. And you're thinking, well, that's great for veterinarians, but I'm thinking if cats see the veterinarian more often, that is great for cats too. So despite the strong momentum, by the way, if I haven't made it clear, more cats than ever before are seeing the veterinarian. And that is despite, or in spite of, economic pressures that are a reality for many, many people, if not most people, in this country. But cats are getting to the vet more often. As more cat owners, I've been a part of the communication for all this for many years. You know, I've been told, well, my cat is indoors only. I don't need to go to the vet after the initial vaccines. Huh? Does that mean your cat cannot get diabetes? Well, in fact, more likely to, because we have so many cats that are overweight or obese. And as we'll be talking about in a couple of weeks, actually, there is a direct association between obesity and being overweight in cats to diabetes. But unless you can do a blood test in your kitchen for your cat, how would you know necessarily that your cat is diabetic? Oh, you might finally understand there is something very wrong when your cat gets very sick. But waiting until that happens can have dire consequences. Also, how can you possibly diagnose hyperthyroid cats or even cancers in cats necessarily? So going to the veterinarian does make cats healthier. But in addition to that, the big question is, what's the barrier then? So, yes, absolutely, finances are a barrier for many people. I have no doubt about that, more than ever before. But it's more than that. Just getting cats to the veterinarian isn't always a simple task. So the carrier comes out, and where does the cat go? I don't know. You don't know. Nobody knows, because the cat is hiding, right? So getting that cat to the veterinarian is still actually the number one barrier. And we can carrier train our cats. And that is something I'll be talking much more about in future weeks. But the good news is that there's good news for cats. I am now going to take literally 1 minute to talk about my book. My most recent book. I've contributed to several, many veterinary textbooks, I'm honored to say. Have written a couple of books and contributed to books for the public in one way or another. This one is my first book for children, but it's really for adults as well, and it's called Ask the Dog. So there are too many dog bites. We have a record number of dog bites because we are not paying attention to what dogs are telling us. Dogs are always communicating with us, but sometimes, often, we don't understand what they're saying. And sometimes we don't care, but we need to care. And we need to understand not only to lower dog bites, but to respect dogs. If they are saying, I don't want to interact right now, maybe that's the right thing. So you can get the book, Ask the Dog, wherever you purchase your books. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.